The current sub-freezing temperatures have led many of us to pull out our wool sweaters, coats, hats, and gloves for extra warmth. So for this week's Please Explain, we have decided to find out what makes wool the fabric of choice during cold times. And joining us are Clara Parks, author of The Knitter's Book of Wool, The Ultimate Guide to Understanding, Using, and Loving This Most Fabulous Fiber. Also, The Knitter's Book of Yarn, The Ultimate Guide to Choosing, Using, and Enjoying Yarn. And Dr. Christopher Lupton, Professor of Animal Fiber Research, the Bill Sims Wool and Mohair Research Laboratory at the Texas AgriLife Research and Extension Center in San Angelo, which is part of the Texas A&M system. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And we also invite our audience to call us with questions. Our number is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Clara, let's begin with you. Do we have any idea how long humans have been using wool?
Well, we know the oldest known sample of wool in textiles dates back about 3,500 years. So quite a bit of time. And we know that in ancient Greece, as far back as 2300 BC, they had a thriving sheep industry. And then by the time the Romans arrived in England, there was a thriving woolen industry there. So it goes back a pretty good long time.
Well, would they have just used the pelts of dead animals before they realized that they could make wool?
That's probably what happened. It's a little bit tricky because wool doesn't keep as well as, you know, early silk fragments or cotton fragments. But that's kind of what they assume happened. And then they finally realized that they could take the fiber off and twist it and make wonderful things with it.
Chris, when we say wool, are we talking about hair, fur, or something different?
Yeah, I think most of the time when we use the term wool, we're thinking about sheep's wool. But technically and commercially, when that word is used, it also involves fiber from other animals. And, you know, we think about the fiber from Angora goats, mohair, alpaca, llama, musk ox, gives us kiviat, and so on. So depending on your perspective, wool can mean just the fiber from sheep or fiber from some of these other species.
In fact, I saw a documentary recently that pointed out during World War II, French fashion designers were using pet fur to make wool.
Using what fur?
Pet fur, cats and dogs.
Really?
Hair.
Yeah.
Well, you can, can't you? Couldn't you use human hair to make wool or some form of wool?
Well, certainly cat fur. Some cats have a very fine undercoat that sheds certain times of year, can be combed out or actually shorn and made into some beautiful fine yarns that would be very similar to cashmere, for example.
Clara, what are the qualities of wool that make it such a good material for clothing?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's the fineness of the fiber that grows off of the animal, but also the natural curl pattern, which is technically called crimp. And these are teeny, teeny, tiny curls in the really fine, fine wools. And what they do is they help hold open fabric so that it can hold still air and keep warm. But they also, those little crimps combined with the structure of the fiber inside, gives it extraordinary elasticity. You can stretch a wool fiber by about 30%, and it'll come right back to where it was. So it's got elasticity. It's got this wonderful loft, which gives it a great handle to touch. And it also has a good amount of strength. If you spin it properly, you can have a wonderful, long-lasting, warm, absorbent pair of socks.
But cotton doesn't have that crimp?
No. Cotton, it's more, if you imagine, a vanilla bean. So it started as a fiber growing around a seed pod that was full of water. And then once it was picked, it started to dry out and kind of compress on itself. So that's the extent of the surface structure that it has. Whereas sheep's wool, I mean, you can have many, many, many teeny tiny little zigzags per inch of fiber, and that helps the fibers hold together and stay cohesive in yarn and in a garment.
Are synthetic fibers that are used as substitutes for wool similar to wool?
Well, they've tried. I mean, they've tried to give them the crimp. They've tried to make them as fine as wool, but what they haven't been able to replicate is the very complicated system inside the wool fiber. You've got this outer, the orthocortex, the paracortex, all these different layers that provide all these different functions. It's kind of like an internal air conditioning system. So it's constantly sucking in moisture when it's too moist outside, too humid, and then it releases it when it is less humid outside. And those types of things, synthetic fibers, they are just, it's a solid tube of goo that's been solidified. And so it can look like wool, but it doesn't behave necessarily like wool.
My guests are Clara Parks and Dr. Christopher Lupton. We're talking about wool on today's Please Explain. And again, a reminder, our phone number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. Chris, one of the complaints about wool is that it's often itchy. Why is it itchy, and why are some people allergic to it?
Well, some people believe they're allergic to it.
You say some people believe they're allergic?
Some believe they're allergic to it, but saying that is really like saying you're allergic to human hair, which most of us obviously aren't, because we have hair on our heads and body hair that we're not allergic to. The chemistry of sheep's wool, mohair, and all these other animal fibers is very, very similar to human hair. Now, before the sheep's wool is scoured, before it's washed, while it's on the sheep's back, then it contains a lot of other things. It contains the natural grease and dried suint that the sheep exudes, and it contains contaminants from the environment, dirt and vegetable material and so on. But after it's been washed and cleaned, all those contaminants are gone, and the chemistry is very similar to human hair. So it's very hard to believe in or imagine a true allergy. However, there is obviously some physical discomfort when coarse fibers are placed next to the skin. And I think the complaints that we hear about allergies or discomfort or itchiness and so on stems from the fact that sometimes people use the wrong type of wool in a particular product. And so
what do you mean by the wrong type of wool? Are the softest?
Wool,
go ahead.
Yeah, there's a very broad spectrum of finenesses in across different breeds of sheep, and for any type of garment that's going to be worn next to the skin, we've found out through research that those types of fabrics should not contain fibers greater than 30 microns in diameter, a micron being 1/1,000,000th of a meter. Now, this applies to any type of fiber, not just wool, but synthetic or whatever. If those coarser fibers are next to the skin, then they tend to prickle people with sensitive skin. So we've learned that if the textile is going to be worn next to the skin, we should use very fine wools containing fibers no coarser than about 30 microns.
And the finer wools depend on the breed? How many breeds are there? We're just talking about sheep right now, but we mentioned earlier there are all sorts of other animals that we also can get wool from.
Yeah, yes, there are many breeds around the world and also in this country. But the type that are used for particularly clothes that are going to be worn next to the skin, the fine wool breeds, are relatively few and represented primarily by the Rambouillet and the Merino types here in the U.S.
Clara, can you explain the process that wool goes through to get from the sheep to a skein of yarn?
Well, it normally happens once a year. As Dr. Lupton said, there are many, many types of sheep out there, over 200 distinct breeds and many, many more. So some of them grow tons and tons of fiber, and they can be shorn twice a year. But normally, once a year, the sheep go in for a haircut. And at that point, and a skilled shearer can do this with electric shears, it takes about 2 minutes. They just go zip, 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 remove the sheep, and then you see on the ground a fleece splayed out that looks like a sheep from which the sheep has been removed. It's quite fun.
But it's always sheared by hand?
There are, and maybe Dr. Lupton can talk more about that. I don't know if there are actually any machines that can do it. It's a living animal, you know, and the finer wool sheep, the merinos, they've been raised to have a lot of square footage of skin so that they can grow a lot of fiber. And so with these folds of skin, it's really hard to do that with anything other than a human hand because you can nick the skin and have quite an unhappy sheep.
So it's shorn. And then it's cleaned. Years ago, we used to hear about lanolin being something we want to put into our hair products. Lanolin is a natural part of this whole process. Now, do we just wash it out?
Yeah, lanolin, it's a natural grease the sheep secretes as it's growing the fiber. It protects the sheep's skin. It protects the fiber. And then during scouring, that water is separated and purified, and the lanolin is removed, and it's still today sold to the cosmetics industry. I was in London this summer, and I got a tub of hand cream, and the primary ingredient was lanolin. It's still right there.
Chris, what happens if a sheep is never shorn?
Well, it will, because the wool will keep growing, some breeds will shed. They will just naturally shed some of the older breeds. But, you know, We've got examples on record of sheep in, one in New Zealand, I think it wasn't captured for 12 years, and it had wool on it, you know, over 3 feet long. But most of the time, particularly in our range country, if a sheep is not shorn, after a couple of years, it will get entangled in brush and probably die. So it's pretty important that the animals are gathered and shorn on a regular basis.
Clara, wool clothes need to be dry cleaned. Why can't they be hand washed?
Oh, I have to confess, I've never, ever sent anything wool to a dry cleaner.
Oh, really? You how do you keep them from shrinking?
Well, I should say, like, if I had a fine Italian suit, that I would definitely send to the dry cleaner just because I wouldn't dare drop that in the washing machine. But wool shrinks. It's basically the teeny tiny microscopic scales that cover the outside of all wool fibers. And we have them on our hair, too. You can feel them if you run your fingers the wrong way back toward your scalp. You'll feel this resistance. And what happens is if you take a piece of wool fabric, put it in warm water and add soap, which changes the pH of the water. The wool wants to absorb. It can absorb up to 30% of its weight in moisture before it ever feels wet to the touch. So it's just like a sponge. It sucks up the water and the fiber expands, and then all of those teeny tiny cells pop out like the scales pop out kind of like the edges of an umbrella. And then you start agitating, and that is what causes all the fibers to become enmeshed, and the fabric gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm. So the key thing there is just minimal agitation. You know, you fill a sink with lukewarm water, you drop in your garment, and you just gently tap, 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 squeeze and pull it out, and then you repeat until it's rinsed.
Now, what causes sweaters to pill? Is there any way to prevent that?
Is a factor of the loose ends of fiber that stick out of fabric, and the shorter the fiber that goes into the fabric, like cashmere, you know, a lot of the cashmere sweaters now that are available for $65, they tend to pill instantly because they're very short fibers. They stick out of the fabric, and then with friction, they meet one another, and they start to pull out. So a smoother fabric, a fabric containing yarn that's been spun much more tightly, there are fewer ends sticking out. That will keep fiber or fabric from pilling, and then what else? Oh, longer fibers. Just if you think about it, fiber is anchored in fabric. So the more there is anchoring it, the less likely it is to slide out under abrasion and give you those icky pills.
So we should probably look for wool that is more hair and not just mohair. Chris, can you explain the research you're doing at the Bill Sims Wool and Mohair Research Laboratory?
Our research, Leonard, is geared towards helping the sheep producer make more money out of his sheep. And so being in the fiber field and working primarily with fine wool sheep, we're always trying to find methods of producing, getting the sheep to produce more wool and finer wool, which is more valuable, which will return more to the producer. Now, we have to do that, or we need to do that, while maintaining lamb production, because we have to remember that although the rancher or farmer is in the wool business, he's mainly in the lamb business. In the case of our fine wool Rambouillet sheep, probably less than 20% of his income will come from selling wool, and the other 80+% will come from selling lamb. And so that's been a big part of our work, modifying through genetic selection, modifying the sheep to produce finer, more valuable wool.
But when you say providing lamb, you mean meat.
I mean meat.
So yes, how long do they do sheep farmers, sheep ranchers, whatever, keep the sheep for wool before they convert it and send it off to the slaughterhouse?
It usually doesn't work that way, Leonard. Typically, when the lambs are born, obviously male or female, most of the males, not all, but most of the males will go to the meat market. Some of the females will, and then the better females will be kept as replacements. And typically, lambs that are in the age range of 8 months to 12 months are what finish up in the meat market.
My guests are Dr. Christopher Lupton, Professor of Animal Fiber Research at the Bill Sims Wool and Mohair Research Laboratory at the Texas AgriLife Research and Extension Center in San Angelo, part of the Texas A&M system, and Clara Parks, who's the author of a number of books for knitters, the Knitter's Book of Wool, the Knitter's Book of Yarn. And we will continue our conversation, take a lot of calls. Our number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. But first this. We're back with our guest Clara Parks and Dr. Christopher Lupton talking about wool on today's Please Explain segment. A listener says that she was raised believing that Irish sweaters, the fisherman sweaters, and Kowachan sweaters should not be dry cleaned because the lanolin is vital to the warmth that they provide. Clara?
Oh, yeah. I know. I would absolutely agree with that. That not only vital to the warmth that they provide, but also it acts kind of like Gore-Tex. The more lanolin you have in there, the more it resists the penetration of wind. So it can make them almost waterproof. They call them oiled sweaters. They still exist over in the UK.
And you don't wash out the lanolin when you're washing them in soap and water?
Well, you do, and you can actually get little lanolin cakes, and you can re-oil your sweater, which seems kind of counterproductive, but it's definitely done. It's sort of like re-spraying your shoes every once in a while to keep them waterproof.
Chris, Christine asks, why does alpaca yarn shed so much?
Well, I think she has a yarn that's shedding badly, it's probably a poorly constructed yarn. Maybe the fiber was a bit too short when it was included in there, or maybe there's not enough twist in the yarn, but alpaca yarn should not shed excessively.
Let's take a couple of calls. We go to Deborah from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, hi. Clara is a rock star in the knitting world, and I'm so excited to be talking to her. We're friends on Facebook, even. I'm really a compulsive knitter, and I managed to survive the Bush years as well as a divorce knitting through it. And I'm delighted to say that Clara has educated me now where I understand what it is I'm knitting. Her two books were very helpful in understanding the technology behind the fiber that I selected. It wasn't just touching and ooing and feeling it. It is a lot more complicated than that, and I really appreciate it. And I wondered why she made that transition from being just a knitter and designer to actually writing about the technology of knitting.
I've always loved the materials that go into it for me. And from every week for the last 10 years, I have a publication called Knitter's Review, and every week I review a yarn. Basically, you go through the whole knitting experience and how does it wash and how does it wear. And the more I did that, the more I realized that there's just incredible nuance within these materials, and there are amazing stories, just entire history, the evolution of global development, politics. Everything can be traced back in one way or another to fiber. You had the Silk Road. You know, England, the whole empire was built on the Cotswold sheep. And so I felt like there were a lot of stories and there's a lot of interesting subtext that I wanted to go into.
Mike, I'm moving on to the next thing. Mike wrote in from Jackson Heights, wool used to be promoted as a naturally fire-retardant fabric suitable for use by gas utility workers. Is that true or a myth, Chris?
Yes, wool we refer to as a flame-retardant fiber. Given enough heat and air, of course, it will burn. Mm-hmm. But unlike synthetics, it does not melt. It goes from solid to a flame, and there's no dripping molten polymer as there is, say, with nylon or polyester. So this makes it suitable for things like the clothes that firemen wear, the protective clothes they wear, and for military uniforms, anywhere where you might be exposed to excessive heat, then wool is an extremely good fiber. But more recently, particularly in Europe, but also in this country, people are starting to use it as insulation in their homes, in the walls and in the ceilings and in the attics. And for that purpose, it has been necessary to add some extra flame retardant to make wool truly flame retardant and not just flame resistant. So just a subtle difference there, but when it comes to flame retarding a house, you know, it's pretty important.
Our number here is 646-829-3985. Let's go to Bill from Williamsburg. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Well, I have to just say I'm very excited about the theme of today's show because I'm a self-proclaimed wool fanatic or aficionado. And I've got a couple of questions. One is I have a Vicuña jacket, which is my piece de resistance. But when I bought it in the thrift store, there was an older woman that told me that there's quite a history to Vicuña coats. And at one point, they were banned in the U.S. because they have to kill the Vicuñas to actually get the wool. And my question is, do they now have a sustainable way of actually recouping that wool from the Vicuñas? That's one question. And the second question is, you guys were talking a lot about how wool keeps you warm, but I noticed when I was in Morocco in the heat, a lot of the people that were there were actually wearing these like wool cloaks, and apparently those wool cloaks actually helped to keep them cool. So I was wondering if you could tell me about those two things.
I'd like to tackle the second one first, Claire, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, wool and mohair, these animal fibers are really excellent in warmer climates, particularly if they're made into lightweight fabrics. And in that particular situation, you can imagine a person sweating and producing moisture. That moisture is wicked away from the body by the wool, So absorbed into the wool, as Claire mentioned earlier, wool can absorb at least 30% of moisture without feeling wet. But in a hot climate, that wool, then that moisture evaporates from the wool. And as it does, that is an endothermic reaction, and it actually produces coldness. It appears cool as the moisture evaporates from the wool. So that's why it's so good in warm climates.
Now, let's address his other question and also something that has been written in by a listener. He asked about vicuna, and a listener asked about whether the production of merino wool involves cruelty.
I know some bit about the vicuna. I know that there are attempts now. They've been working with native tribes down there to kind of regulate this. They've allowed a certain number of animals to be slaughtered every year, and they're trying. From what I understand about the vicuna, it's a very timid animal, and just the gathering them together and trying to shear them, some of them have just died of heart attack. It's been so traumatic for them. So, but I know there are steps being taken to create a more sustainable, more animal-friendly vicuna, and also guanaco, which is another very fine camelid that's like the vicuna's cousin down there. And I bet you could find out more about that in Wild Fibers magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think another point, Claire, is that people in the alpaca business, through genetic selection, are producing finer and finer alpaca.
Yeah.
It's not quite as fine as vicuna at this point, but it's certainly approaching. So that's another possible mechanism of getting this really fine fiber from a close relative.
Where is most of the wool we get coming from, Chris?
Well, most of the wool we wear is probably coming from Australia or New Zealand. About 75% of our domestic clip now is sent overseas. It's mainly sent to China, India, some of the European countries where it's processed. The rest, a good amount of the balance, is used by the U.S. military for their uniforms, processed in this country from raw material to the finished fabric and used by our military. But most of the imports, the stuff coming in from China, Italy, probably emanated in Australia.
How do a number of listeners want to know how you prevent moth holes in old wool textiles and sweaters? And I'm going to throw in another one because we're running out of time. A listener asks about woolite, whether it's actually something good for washing wool fabrics.
As far as moths are concerned, I always tell people that you have to put a physical barrier between the wool textile and the moth. So if you're through with the sweater for the year, put it in a cedar chest or in some heavy plastic, something. But a physical barrier is the only thing, I believe, that can truly stop the moth getting to them. No. I had a professor tell me one time if the only way mothballs could stop moths getting into wool is if you threw them at the moths and actually managed to hit them. So.
On top of it all, they do leave an awful smell. What about woolite, Clara?
You know, I've been raised with an anti-woolite bent, and I don't. It's one of those. Perhaps it's even an urban myth at this point. But I kind of my rule of thumb is don't wash your sweaters in something you wouldn't wash your hair in. So you don't want to use something with harsh detergents that can strip the fibers of their natural luster and some of that natural oil. There are a lot of really good wool washes now. There's a Eucalan, that's one. There's a wool wash called Soak. When in doubt, use a very gentle, like a baby shampoo. Works just as well. Or even Ivory dish soap.
Now, what is virgin wool? I know what virgin olive oil is.
Virgin wool, it is when you see that on a label, that means that is that fiber's first foray into the fabric world.
Oh, because it's often recycled?
Yeah. It especially during World War II, that's when they started with this. They set up shoddy mills that would literally shred woolen blankets and things back into a spinnable material and do something else with them. It's not so common anymore, at least that I know of, but it's a very, you know, attractive and exotic-looking word to put on labels, so it still finds its way there.
Chris, what about boiled wool? Is it really boiled?
Yeah, it is.
Well, what does the boiling do for it?
Well, the products that I'm familiar with are felted products, so that, you know, you first of all make a structure, whether it be knitted or woven, and then boiling it and mechanically squeezing it basically converts it into a felt. Is that your understanding, Claire? Am I missing?
No, that's exactly it.
So I think the boiling just accelerates the felting process in that case, you know, the physical agitation of the boiling.
Claire, when you go to purchase wool, are there certain criteria that you apply?
I call it yarn whispering. Really, it's kind of, you can get a little bit woo-woo about this. You know, when you hold a skein up to your ear, can you hear the sound of the sheep that raise the fiber?
You actually put it to your ear?
Oh, you do.
Shake it and listen to the sound like a melon?
You can. I mean, knitters have some very embarrassing habits. You rub it against your cheek. You definitely smell it because fibers hold a lot of odor or fragrance. You can tell where it's been in a way. You rub it against your cheek. Sometimes people will tuck it down their shirt very gently.
Mm-hmm.
You'll pull out a little, just one little strand and kind of untwist it to figure out how it was constructed and maybe stroke it a little bit to see how many fibers along the surface start to come loose. We're talking about alpaca shedding. That's how you can tell with other yarns if it's going to shed.
And I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating Please Explain look at wool. Clara Parks is the author of The Knitter's Book of Wool, The Ultimate Guide to Understanding, Using, and Loving This Most Fabulous Fiber, and The Knitter's Book of Yarn, The Ultimate Guide to Choosing, Using, and Enjoying Yarn. And Dr. Christopher Lupton is a professor of animal fiber research at the Bill Sims Wool and Mohair Research Laboratory at the Texas AgriLife Research and Extension Center in San Angelo, which is part of the Texas A&M system. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.